This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Monday, time for our Zoomer squad, and we are speeding to a terrible new tariff deadline on Wednesday without an agreement in sight, though you never know. And there's polling that shows that Canadians do not want our government to make further concessions and cave to Donald Trump. At the same time, other polls show that our very conciliatory Prime Minister, Mark Carney, is just as popular as ever. Now, as they say, two things can be true at once. But I think that especially among Zoomers, Carney continues to be hailed for not being Justin Trudeau. He conducts himself in a I would say in a pretty good and appropriate way. Now, sometimes I get the pulse on what's going on just being out and about in my circle. I was at a dinner party yesterday, and the conversation turned, not led by me, to how embarrassed people are by Trudeau's antics with his celebrity girlfriend, all of his shtick, and I think that most of the people there had not even seen the latest cringy video of Trudeau and Katy Perry singing and dancing to Trudeau's son's new song. And it's not the clearest on radio, but let's play a really short clip just to give people an idea. That's Katy Perry stamping her feet. I mean, really. So meanwhile, aside from the latest on the Trudeau front, there are all kinds of developments municipally, provincially, federally, and all kinds of jurisdictional battles that we will try to sort out. So the numbers to call, 866-740-4740, that's our text line, 416-360-0740.
And now, time for the Zoomer Squad.
And now I'd like to welcome David Valentin, principal at Liaison Strategies, Rob Davis, a former Toronto City Councillor, and Janet Ecker, former Ontario PC MPP and Finance Minister. Happy Monday, everyone.
Happy Monday, Libby.
Happy Monday.
Okay, well, shall we start from the ridiculous to the sublime? People are just, I don't know, embarrassed about the way Trudeau is comporting himself on the world stage as our former prime minister. Like, just really embarrassed. David, what do you make of that?
Well, maybe I'll have to be the contrarian here. You know, a father promotes his son's new song with his girlfriend is my summary of it. I find it hard to be outraged at that because I don't know what else he would do to promote his son's song. But, you know, I was thinking about this when I saw the topics, and I remember that last week we had Stephen Harper at an international conference at PragerU telling the international audience that Canadian media is all MSNBC. I guess I care more about the substance of people and the way that they frame our country, right? That's our former prime minister basically saying that, well, not basically, he said the reason he lost the election is because Corey Tenek started Sun News Network and took the only conservative journalists away to this network, leaving all these liberal left reporters at TTV News and Global News and so on. I care more about that, I think, than I care about Justin Trudeau dancing. I also don't know what we expect him to do. He's not prime minister anymore. He's a private citizen. I think he should be able to enjoy himself and date whoever he wants. I think most people would say he's done pretty well in dating Katy Perry, and I think he seems very happy. He seems very happy. So I don't know why I would be offended or be upset, but that's just me.
Yeah, I think it is just you, frankly. Rob, what do you think? I mean, this came up, and I think that lately the take you hear is that Justin Trudeau was a disaster. I'm not sure he was as big as a disaster as people are now saying, but, you know, he wasn't great. And I think all of this plays into it. He's just, you know, he's a celebrity that is considered not serious. What do you think,
well,
Rob?
Well, I mean, he's young enough that dancing around in a hardware store, he's not going to require any chiropractic adjustments or anything like that. But compared to his predecessors, the folks who were maybe a little older, a little bit more mature by the time they reached their post-prime ministerial periods in their lives. But those former prime ministers have gone on to do substantive things. I don't know that this is good for Trudeau himself in terms of his reputation. Oftentimes, former prime ministers get invited to be on boards and commissions, and they sit on boards of private sector companies because they are seen to have sort of a substantive, some gravitas that they'll bring to the role. I think, and I agree in part with David. You know, he's promoting his son's music with his pop star girlfriend, but does that help cement Trudeau's reputation for, you know, things that he may want to do in the future? I'm not so sure that it'll help him, but he's certainly demonstrating, you know, some people accuse him of being the Nepo prime minister. Well, he's certainly making sure that his son perhaps will be branded as a Nepo pop star. If in fact his son's records do very, very well because of the Katy Perry endorsement.
Well, Janet, what do you make of this before we move on to more serious topics?
Oh, please, let's move on to more serious topics. I mean, if I was his son, I think I'd be embarrassed that my father was dancing around a hardware store with a toilet plunger in his arm, waving it around, singing my song and singing it very badly. I mean, anyway, all it does is confirm what all the naysayers said about him. When he was prime minister, and he's demeaning the role, he's giving the thumb to Canadians, quite frankly, or the finger, I guess, to Canadians. And let's just talk about something more substantial and that matters more to Canadians.
Okay, well, I just got a text saying the same thing. Let's talk about other things. So there's been polling, David, that Canadians really do not want more concessions to Donald Trump. How do you see that?
Well, we saw a new polling today from our firm as well. Mark Carney's approval rating hitting 60%, best numbers of all summer, coming now as we reach the trade deadline. I think the real risk here is a bad deal. And it's going to sound strange, but we should want a deal, even if it's not the perfect deal. But I think if we give up major concessions, this is going to look really bad for the government. Canadians have told us in survey after survey in public consultations, they would rather no deal than a bad deal. So how is it going to look if we don't get proper treatment for lumber, proper treatment for autos? That's a big question mark. And I think this is where Mark Carney will have more of a risk. I think there's more of a risk in a bad deal than striking a really flawed deal. And one thing to keep in mind, the Americans have not followed any of their deals.
They sign deals and then they
promptly break them. So what would be the point of this? I don't even know to a certain extent, but we need certainty for investment. We need we ideally would get to a reasonable deal with a reasonable person. I don't know that that's going to be possible.
Well, you know, speaking of left-wing media, I've seen reporting on the weekend saying, the American chief negotiator took a Zoom call on the weekend, left his birthday party. I mean, every negotiation for almost anything that I've ever seen goes down to the wire, and to present that as a good sign, I don't know. I think it's really reaching. I mean, the other thing we saw on the weekend is this news from Lana Payne, who is the head of Unifor, saying that she was informed by Stellantis that they may be selling the plant. Now, I think for her, that's part of her bargaining as well. But how serious is that, Janet?
Well, I think it's very serious, and we're starting to see that some companies are moving and changing the way they do business and stuff. You know, it's not that they necessarily want to leave Canada, but it's getting pretty tough for some of them to stay here with the pressures that they're facing. I can see. I mean, I do have some sympathy for Carney and the negotiators, because they lose either way. Canada loses either way. We either get a bad deal, or maybe we get a deal that might not be so bad, but will he live up to it? You know, we're going to have to pay a price, and it's quite alarming. Canadians are saying, let's hang tough, let's fight back. I get that. But after 6 months of, closures, job losses, the kinds of things that could happen, the kind of retribution that Trump might take on the country, it'll be interesting to see how long we'll all hang in, because it will be very painful for a lot of people. But yeah, Canadians do want to push back, and it's not fair, it's not right, but it's the reality that we are living, unfortunately. And while there are good steps that are, you know, many companies, the governments are trying to take, we haven't done enough fast enough to compensate for what's going to come hit us, deal or no deal.
Well, one of the things that I hear floated around a lot is that a lot of people think that one of the only things that has resonated with the negotiators is Doug Ford banning American booze, even though there are all kinds of people who say we should put it back just, you know, without getting anything in return, Rob.
Well, you know, it reminds me of watching an old police series. You need a good cop and a bad cop. And if Doug Ford is playing his role as the bad cop, then so be it. And I think it works for him. He likes playing that role. He likes being the tough guy. And I think it just helps Carney. Like, you know, a lot of people will maybe suggest that Carney and Ford are at odds with each other. Make no mistake about it. They're on the same team. And they're each playing their role in this negotiation process. And Doug Ford can be the guy who holds out to the very end. It will help him, I think. You know, David might confirm this. It will help him in any polling that comes up. They like his stance on this. You know what? Alcohol is something that I don't really need. Personally, I don't have to drink Jack Daniels. I could just as easily buy a very nice wine from Niagara Falls or from British Columbia or what have you. Although I can't get those wines, but anyway, that's another story. But Janet's laughing because she knows of what I speak. But the issue is, we need to have a multi-front battle with the United States, or in this trade war, we're on multiple fronts. The provinces can play a great role in all of this, and Doug Ford's playing his role, because the federal government can say, well, those are provincial jurisdictions. You certainly wouldn't weigh in on states' rights in the U.S., and so we certainly won't weigh in or try to infringe on the rights of provinces to regulate what they buy. But we can use it as a tool. But you know, there's also a lot of other things happening. The midterms are a factor. So how this is going to play out and how it's going to affect the results of elections in the U.S. is also something that could be on our side. That could be a weapon as well. We just have to be careful to keep our powder dry, not to look like we're interfering in their domestic political activities. And, I'm Team Canada all the way. I want Carney to be successful. I want Ford to be successful, because we need Canada to be successful. But getting even a good deal with a cheater is not really a good deal in the end. And that's the problem. If they break every single agreement, you know, what good is having a good deal?
Exactly. There are all kinds of other developments on the municipal front, David. I mean, Jack Layton's son, Mike Layton, is running against Diane Sachs. I know you characterize this as the clash of the titans. That might be a little bit grandiose for them. But it's two left-wing candidates, though I think on a personal level, I think Mike Layton is a little more personable.
Well, it's going to be really interesting to watch, because the power of incumbency at the municipal level is so large. Now, you've got Mike Layton, who is a quasi-incumbent. He was the incumbent. But then you've got Diane Sachs, who does fold the seat. And I don't know that it will be automatic that he is able to just walk right back in. I think there is going to be some hard work that needs to take place. He's going to have to raise the money, find the volunteers. And, you know, University of Rosedale is an interesting riding because a lot of people do move in and out of it. You've got sections where there's not a lot of movement, primarily the Rosedale, but all the stuff on the east, it's a very transient part of Toronto where people are constantly moving, renting, and you know, going on their way throughout the city. It's one of their many stops. So are those people going to remember Mike Layton since he never represented them, right? He's going to have to introduce himself to a new subset of voters. And I think it will be interesting to see how it all plays out.
Are they going to remember Diane Sachs? A lot of people, especially small businesses, et cetera, don't like her. You know, as happened, as we said with Bonnie Crombie moving into the Mississauga race, there might be people there who don't even know that he left. And he's got the advantage of the last name, Rob. You're nodding your head.
Yeah, I mean, look, he has Jack Layton's last name, and he will have presumably the support of his stepmom, Olivia Chow. And so, you know, let's not forget that there's an entire machinery that's built around her. She has a charity that she operated out of the university formerly known as Ryerson, TMU, and that was their sole purpose was to train people on how to campaign. I mean, the sole purpose of the charity was political activism, where they claim on their website to have trained over 10,000 people on, you know, advocacy. So I don't think it's going to be a clash of titans so much as a question about whether or not people are going to want to vote for somebody who's been working hard as their local councillor or whether they're going to vote for somebody who won the sperm lottery.
Okay, I think I know where you stand on that. Now, here's a topic that we're going to explore in depth in our next segment, Janet. But late Friday afternoon, and I am flummoxed about why this would slide in late Friday afternoon, the province announced allegedly tougher bail requirements in effect as of today. There's already talk of court challenges, whether the government, the questions, do they have the jurisdiction to enforce this? Whenever we've talked about bail before, I have said I think people would be shocked to know that right now bail is not enforced, right? You don't have to put up bail to get bail. And even more unusual, or in the cases where people actually put up bail, you don't forfeit bail if the person skips out. So I think people are still wrapping their heads around that. But there's this now requirement that that the person who puts up the bail, the surety, would have to come up with the actual money within 2 days. So do you think that the province, I don't know, are they just trying to show that they're doing something, or is this something that can have an impact?
Well, I hope it has an impact because it's certainly responding to, I think, the outrage that people have to keep reading about people committing crimes, people hurting our police force, you know, shooting and all of that that's going on by people who've been out on bail again and again and again and again. I mean, the political rhetoric about the revolving door is exactly correct. So I think Ford, the premier, is showing what he's responding to what people want to have happen. I don't know if it's going to work or not, but listen, somebody had to do something. So more power to him. And we'll see if it has any impact in terms of curtailing some of the revolving door that we've been seeing in the jails these days. Because somebody's got to do something.
Janet, you've been high up in a provincial government. I mean, just on the face of it, I know you're not a legal expert, but do you think that this has a chance of succeeding?
Well, given our courts from time to time, it's a little tough to predict. And we're, as we're seeing with the bike lane issue that's just come out, of course, someone's going to take them to court. I mean, that's, you know, there are people who, it's all they do. You know, they just sit around trying to figure out what to take to court. So it'll get challenged and we'll see what happens. But even if it gets thrown out, I mean, he will try to find another way to do it. And I think he should, because it really desperately needs to be to happen. Our justice system needs to be held in higher regard than what some of the crooks would appear to be, you know, regarding it with. And they've got to stop it, or at least try to curtail it. And this is at least a step and a significant step, both symbolic and hopefully in reality, that might slow down that revolving door.
Well, as I said, we are going to be getting to this in depth in the next segment, but I would be remiss if we didn't talk about bike lanes and this court ruling that came out on Friday afternoon that is already being challenged, saying that that bike lanes, having bike lanes is actually not a constitutional right. And the judge erred in trying to say that that it was unconstitutional to rip them out. Rob?
Well, I think this is the right decision. I mean, you can support bike lanes, but not support a particular location of bike lanes. The suggestion that this is a constitutional right, I think, is a little bit of overreach on the part of the lower court.
A little?
Just a little.
A little?
I'm being, you know, I'm trying to be modest in my in my anger. You know, I've done interviews on the radio standing in those bike lanes, talking about bike lanes at Bloor and Royal York Road near where I live, and have spent, you know, 10, 15 minutes on radio interviews, and not one cyclist has gone by during, you know, whether it's rush hour or midday, sunny days, good weather days. I mean, at the end, they're not really being utilized. The theory behind them was that if you build it, they will come. And in this particular case, nobody came. They built it and nobody showed up. Now, I ride my bike in those lanes. I was facetiously suggesting they could name them after me because I'm pretty much the only one on the bike lane at the time that I ride them. And I just think that it was overreach on the part of courts, also overreach on the part of city council. The idea that bike lanes bring business to communities is based on a false premise, a false report that was done back in 2016, 2017. Because, and I've said this on your show before, the College Street was under construction. All of College Street was under construction at the time they put bike lanes in on Bloor Street. And they said, oh, look, we put bike lanes in on Bloor Street and sales went up. Well, yeah, they went up because nobody could drive or walk on College Street to go shopping at the grocery stores on College Street. And the nearest east-west main street was Bloor Street. So the whole premise of the expansion of bike lanes, that it's going to bring economic opportunity and jobs, is based on a false premise. And the council should just recognize that they made a mistake. Yes, put bike lanes in where they're needed, but don't suggest that it's going to save every single small business because they've taken away a lane of driving and parking for them.
Oh, yeah, exactly. David, what can you tell us about why bike lanes are still such a big issue?
Well, they're a big issue because for those who cycle and those who know people who cycle, you know, people die on the road. I think let's just acknowledge this. Bike lanes are not. A lot of people die from motor vehicle fatalities because they're pedestrians and because they're driving bikes. I mean, we've heard a lot about Vision Zero. There's been some significant improvements, but people are still unfortunately passing away after getting hit by a motor vehicle. Just to talk very briefly about the bail changes addressed on Friday, I think we want a safer society, but rather than doing this symbolic thing, which I don't know how it will go because they're trying to rewrite federal bail rules provincially, not sure how that is going to hold up in court, but if the province wants to do something, and I hope you're listening, put the money into courthouses, put the money into jails. Our jails are overcrowded. They cannot. What do you do when the jail has capacity for 1,000 people and 1,500 people are supposed to occupy it? You don't put them in jail. You set them out on these reduced bail conditions because you have no capacity. What do you do when you cannot adjudicate a court matter in criminal court in a timely fashion in 2 years or whatever the timeline is at this particular moment? The charges get thrown out. And then we have a lot of people complaining, why were the charges thrown out? Why was this person let out on bail? And it's because our jails do not have the capacity and our court system does not have the funding to adjudicate things quickly. And if we want to see more people serving the time for the consequences of their actions, we need to actually make those investments to do it. Because we're all presumed innocent until proven guilty. That's the society we live in. So I know it's boring, but we got to do it.
Well, just last week, I saw a press release from the government saying, we're building more jails. There's going to be more capacity in 10 years.
Yep. Yep. In 10 years.
In 10 years. Okay. It's just been a head-spinning day. All of the poobahs are at the Association of Municipalities meeting today in Ottawa. I'm sure there already is a whole raft of news there. In the meantime, thanks so much, David Valentin, Janet Ecker, and Rob Davis. And we'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Bye, Libby.
Okay. As promised, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about these new bail requirements. Is it just for show, or is there a hope that they might actually work? We'll talk to Ari Goldkind when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, as we've been discussing, here's another big development from the late Friday news drop. And as of today, the Ford Progressive Conservatives are requiring, or they have a law requiring, a cash deposit for bail in the full amount that is pledged. And it has to be paid, they say, once an accused person is released on bail, and the payment has to be made within 2 business days. And I say, yes. The public is really sick of all of those cases of people arrested for serious violent crimes while they were out on bail. But the question is, can the province actually enforce this? There's already talk of constitutional challenges, and it depends on the judges and the justices of the peace whose jobs it is to grant bail or not. So, people, what do you think? Are you surprised that most people who are out on bail don't actually have bail paid before they are released at the moment until this came into effect today? Our text line, 866-740-4740 and 416-360-0740. And now let's go to Ari Goldkind, a Toronto-based criminal defense lawyer. Hi, Ari.
Great to be with you, Libby.
So this dropped late Friday afternoon. There's already talk of court challenges. What's your take?
So there is a court challenge coming from the Criminal Lawyers Association and the Civil Liberties Association. We can get to that in a moment. That was inevitable.
Yeah.
That means Ford is on to the right thing, at least politically. But two quick things before we get into the meat of it. Tucked into that Friday release, Libby, which on Friday sometimes goes into the dark hole with our lack of media the way it was 30 years ago. In that bill is also something I think important to your listeners, and it's not a tangent, which is no more researching on dogs and cats for medical purposes and the torture and cruelty that so many animals faced in Canada that Doug Ford took a very loud stand on about a year ago, you'll remember, in London. So that's in the same bill, and I think your listeners would appreciate that. Number two, in the Sun on the weekend, and I know nobody reads newspapers anymore, I understand that, but sometimes they should be read. Lori Goldstein has a great column about the silliness of crime stats, and I'm sure, Libby, and I think you and I talked about it, the press releases that were put out by certain politicians that crime rates are down. And Lori Goldstein wrote a great piece about, no, violent crime is actually way up. And I think that ties into this subject, because you just asked your listeners, what do you feel about these changes and will they make a difference? Now let's get to this issue. I think the government has scored a massive win politically. Even if the court strikes some of this down, Ford gets to stand there and say, well, look, the courts are circling the wagons and striking it down. I'm for law and order. I'm for sureties having skin in the game. rather than these promises where there's really very little recourse if somebody screws the pooch on the, pun intended, on the bail. There's a court called an estreatment court, which isn't used often enough. So Ford has had a huge victory with his Attorney General, Doug Downey. Where I think he's exposed, or the bill is exposed, Libby, is in two places. I like the idea. Now, I don't speak for the Criminal Lawyers Association. My views are antithetical to them, so let your audience know that I am not their spokesperson. I think it's a very good thing that sureties have to put money down and put skin in the game. I think that will change the bail system for the positive. It will get rid of a lot of the surety for hire networks that are going on. And like Voldemort, Libby, nobody talks about them. But now that you have to put money down, that's good. Where I think there's a real problem, and I'll put my defense lawyer hat square on, is two places. One, I don't like that the accused necessarily has to make a cash deposit. Many accused who get bail are homeless, mentally ill, impecunious, don't have two nickels to rub together. And those are the kinds of people that tend to get bail on their own. I don't like that some homeless or mentally ill rounder has to come up with $100 or $200 or $50, because there's already a punishment, Libby, if they don't show up to court, fail to attend charges, fail to appear charges, fail to comply. I also think there is some exposure, and I'll end my answer here before your next question, that the province may, I emphasize only may, be stepping on federal toes. Do I think this kind of legislation would be a lot more likely to succeed if all of the provinces got together, convinced the feds to do this, and the criminal code was amended? I think that would be much stronger constitutionally. But as you know, given last week's stupid bike lane fracas that the Court of Appeal quite properly fixed, I'm sure you know that story where apparently bike lanes are a charter right, and the Court of Appeal in their wisdom said, that's really dumb. One never knows what a court will do when faced with a charter challenge. So those are my, you know, comments on it is, but overall, Libby, bottom line, a positive step.
Okay. So there's this jurisdictional issue, federal government, criminal law, but who appoints justices of the peace and the judges in bail court? Isn't that provincial?
So great question. So I'm going to answer this, Libby, not just to you, but for your listeners who don't know how the sausage is made. The provincial governments appoint the justices of the peace and the judges that tend to hear about 95%, 98% of bail matters. Where you start to see cases get more publicity is when there's a bail decision by a justice of the peace or an Ontario court judge, it gets appealed to a superior court judge. Superior court judges are appointed by the feds, but the bail courts, by and large, are provincially judicially run courts, just to make that make sense to people.
Okay.
The province appoints the people that I'll do it easier. If Libby Znaimer, God forbid, gets arrested, it's going to be a provincially appointed justice of the peace or judge who will hear her situation, unless, God forbid, Libby Znaimer is charged with murder or terrorism.
Okay. So where is the jurisdictional problem?
The criminal code is really a federal matter. It's really a creation of federal statute. While the Ontario government has a solicitor general, an attorney general to implement things, the criminal code is a federal document. What does that mean in English, Libby? That if Libby, God forbid, gets charged in Ontario, she should be subject to the same laws as if she got arrested in Saskatchewan. The idea is uniformity across the provinces. That's why one of the things that the talented lawyers who are going to bring this charter challenge to the bail change are going to say, hey, you guys at the province, Doug Downey, Doug Ford, you have no business meddling in to the bail system in the criminal code. And I can assure you that the provincial government, Mr. Ford and Mr. Downey, probably got one of two things: an opinion from their many lawyers at their law division that says this is kosher, or something which we'll never know about that says maybe we're exposed, but it's such a huge political win to look tough on crime and tough on bail that who cares if we lose?
Well, yeah, the other that one of the questions on the political side, I thought, well, I think it is a political win. So why are they burying it on Friday afternoon? But that's another question.
You can answer that as well as I can, Libby, knowing how the media has changed and how coverage has changed.
Well, yeah. So the other question is, and I've had these questions from very intelligent members of our audience, and they're saying, how do we make the justices and JPs more accountable for their decisions on bail? And you and I have talked about it and said, well, yes, they have to provide reasons, but I cannot report the reasons.
Yeah, and I think there's two different questions there, Libby. One is, can the public find out how the sausage is made on a bail release or a bail detention? The answer is no. There are publication bans on these, so unless one of your listeners has time and inclination to head to the bail courts and listen in person, you're really not going to find these things out. That's a different question, I think, than accountability. What I think your listeners are asking is what happens when a justice of the peace releases a guy on attempted murder charges who's been out on bail two times, one for beating his girlfriend, then for possessing a gun, then gets bail and goes out and shoots that very girlfriend. I think that's what your listeners are asking, which is how does the justice of the peace in a world where people can get fired for looking at somebody the wrong way or telling a bad joke at the imaginary water cooler, how does a justice of the peace keep his or her job if they do this as a pattern? That's an interesting question. I think it's not talked about enough. We don't have time for me to go into that answer, but one of the things I've noticed is there tends to be a disconnect between people who have had crime happen to them or somebody they love or care about versus people that have a private parking spot, private security, go in the courtroom through special doors and special access and don't feel crime as acutely as many people in the community. And I think until judges and justices of the peace start putting themselves in the shoes of people who have been terrorized, low-income communities where the Toronto Star will always pretend that those communities are anti-police, they're not. They're very pro-police. They want to be as safe as you and I can be, Libby. Until there is a change in the zeitgeist in court, and I think this bail change is an important part of that. Look, full disclosure, I think some of Carney's changes go towards that too. Until there's a perception in the criminal justice system that detaining somebody who's obviously dangerous is not going to get that judge or JP in trouble, I don't think we're going to have a change. We saw it, Libby, south of the border with an election where the bad orange man changed the zeitgeist that crime is not to be accepted. We don't have anything like that here.
Okay, just to clarify, when you're referring to people who have private security and parking spots, you're talking about the judges and the JPs.
Yes, with some levity and humor.
Right. But of course, we don't want a situation like in the States where, supporters of the bad orange man endanger judicial officials.
I don't agree with that, but we don't have time for that segment. What my point was, Libby, is I don't agree with that with all due respect. What we have in the States is you don't have people becoming pariahs when they're tough on crime from the bench. Here, it's not the best thing for your career, particularly if you want to get appointed, if you're a tough on crime person.
That's a whole other conversation, Ari, and you're right, we don't have that. Thank you for, explaining some of these difficult concepts, and we'll see how this new rule works out. Thanks so much, as always. Bye-bye.
Good to be with you, Libby.
Thank you. Okay, we're taking another break, and another tough statement today, this time from mayoral candidate Brad Bradford. He wants to see mandatory addiction treatment. And, you know, I think we have similar issues because there isn't enough addiction treatment available, you know, whether it's mandatory or not. But we'll talk to him. And this has to do with some of the no-go areas, the increasing number of no-go areas in the city because of public drug use. We'll talk about all of that when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, if you have ever been near Queen and Bathurst in Toronto, you'll know why people call it Zombie Land. It's just one of the public streets and transit hubs that are overrun by public drug use. Now, Ontario's big city mayors, who are meeting in Ottawa for the second time in 2 years, have asked the province to review the Mental Health Act and the Health Care Consent Act. And Brad Bradford, a mayoral candidate today, is calling for mandatory addiction treatment. He says that we can't wait another 2 years for reviewing this. One of the big problems is that right now you have to wait about 72 days to get into addiction treatments. So let's see what Brad has in mind. Thanks for joining us. Hello.
Hi. It's great to be with you, Libby.
So what are you proposing here?
Well, I think we all have to recognize that when addiction gets so severe that somebody no longer has the wherewithal or the mental capacity to seek the treatment that they desperately need and where their lives are frankly at risk, it is not a compassionate response to abandon them without the necessary resources and pathway to recovery. These individuals in those circumstances need treatment. And I think the rest of us have a collective responsibility to help by making compassionate life-saving decisions to make sure that they can get the treatment to break the cycle of addiction. So I'm of the view that Toronto needs mandatory treatment for those suffering from the health crisis of drug addiction. And we can't afford to wait, you know, another 2 years. It's just been too long without the inaction. And you see that manifesting at Queen and Bathurst. You see it, you know, at Union Station. And you see it out in the suburbs of the city as well.
Yeah, but we don't have enough addiction treatment even to help those who agree voluntarily.
That's right. And so more is needed across the board. There's three components to what I'm putting on the table today. The first is treatment, period. Full stop. I am going to fight for Toronto's full share of new beds for residential treatment and withdrawal management. And supportive housing is a piece of that too, so that you know, when people ask for it, it takes days and not months. And as you pointed out off the top, folks are waiting in excess of 70 days to get into treatment, even when they want it. And that's not adequate. The second piece, Libby, is mandatory treatment law for the most severe cases, where the safeguards are put in place to make sure that, you know, each case is reviewed individually, they have right to counsel, and they have access to continual medication once they get out of treatment. And that's the difference between a law that saves lives and a law that gets struck down in the courts. So we have to do it the right way. And the third piece, and this one's really important, at least 100 recovery house beds right here in Toronto. Because when somebody's ready to get better, there has to be somewhere for them to go. So right now, you might even make your way into a detox facility. You might get some treatment. Maybe you spend 72 hours in the care of a physician through the ER room. But then you're discharged and you end up in a shelter, or you end up in an encampment, or you end up on the streets. And those are the moments when you are most vulnerable to fall back into the cycle of drug addiction and to use more drugs. And so what I'm proposing is recovery houses, that is where you have the supports in place, the proper staffing and the medication that you need to move from detox into a more stable environment that, you know, you're not going to fall victim to the predatory activities that takes place on some of the streets and in our encampments and even in our transit system. So those are the three components. You know, there are other jurisdictions that are moving in the same direction. Mayor Chao has been completely absent on this file. And I think it's time for us to take care of the people who desperately need it and also, you know, make sure that the city is safe for everybody else who's trying to call it home.
I want to talk about the culture of people who are involved in harm reduction, who oversee safe injection sites. I mean, it really came home this week when I saw a picture, and it's posted on X, of a street health worker, and this is an NGO, a non-governmental organization that gets public money, wearing a hat that said, F the police. I can't use the word, but the word wasn't even, it was spelled out in full. So with that kind of attitude in people who are involved in that, I mean, how do you make headway?
Well, look, you know, Vancouver was the jurisdiction in North America that really led on the harm reduction file. They were kind of first, they were out on it many, many years ago, and now they are course correcting. And in fact, the NDP premier there appointed a psychologist, an expert in this field. And this individual is now saying that the challenge with harm reduction is it can't be the only solution. And I think in a lot of these conversations, the problem is when harm reduction stops being a part of a holistic strategy and becomes an ideological movement.
Yeah,
and
but that's
I think for
what
a lot
got.
Of folks, a lot of advocates now, it's an ideological movement. And it can be one part of a system, but it can't be the whole plan. And that is, you know, this.
But
again,
what
this
do you do about this?
Psychiatrist.
What do you do about this pervasive attitude and the people who are pushing it? And with no cost, I can't imagine wearing a hat like that. I mean, in any kind of public, whatever.
Well, I think, like, regardless of the issue, I am not going to be guided by ideology. I'm going to be guided by what works. And we have to look at the evidence. We have to look at where we've been over the past 5 years. We have to understand what's working and what's not working. And again, you can go to really any corner in the city of Toronto now and see this. This is not stuff that takes place in dark alleyways anymore. It's visible in our parks. It's visible on our streets, in our transit system. And that's the reality of the world that we're living in. So I'm going to operate in the reality of the world that we're living in today and put proposals on the table to address these challenges head on. And I think what's regrettable is, you know, you've got the Ontario Big City Mayor's Caucus that is effectively calling for more reviews, more studies, just like they did in October 2024. But the mayor of the largest city in the entire country has been entirely absent from that conversation. You know, she didn't lend her support to that cause 2 years ago. She hasn't lent her support to that cause today. She's not even at the meeting. She's not attending.
Okay, but again, Brad, the question is, if you don't have the people on the ground to enforce this, what do you do?
Sorry. And you were talking about people with an anti-police message.
Right.
No, look, there are resources required, and that's kind of part of this advocacy message. That's the thing that I'm leading with right off the top is we need those resources. And I think everybody would agree this is a public health issue. And you know, healthcare lands firmly with the province, but we need elected officials who are going to stand up in the cities where cities are often ground zero for these types of crises to say, look, what the province and the federal government are doing right now is inadequate. We all need to work together. We need changes to our laws so that we have more tools available for mandatory treatment. We need to invest in the resources to make sure that the treatment is available when people want it. And also the treatment is available for those who are not in a capacity to make that decision for themselves at this point. And then these recovery houses, that has to be part of the plan. And that's a direction that, you know, provinces like British Columbia, Alberta, Manitoba, They're all moving in that direction right now, and we need Ontario to go there too. But it's not going to happen without the leadership here in Toronto, the largest city in the country, to come out there and use the bully pulpit to make this message known to other levels of government that this is an important thing that we have to do together. And, you know, we can't just stick our head in the sand and pretend it's not happening anymore. That is inadequate. And I actually think that is a failure of compassion from our city to abandon these people who desperately need to break the cycle of addiction.
Yeah, the premier has said very similar things. Now, in the meantime, because this all takes time, what do you do with those public spaces that are now inaccessible for families, for, you know, regular people?
Well, I've had proposals on the table, and we've talked about it before. Encampments need to be cleared within 48 hours. And there is more space in our shelter capacity today than there was even a year and a half ago, because the federal government rightly has dialed back the influx of refugees and asylum seekers, which at one point were taking up to 40% of our shelter capacity. So that capacity is there, and that is the first sort of opportunity to triage people who need support, who need help, whether that is counseling or support with addiction. They can get it through there. I know it's not a best case scenario, but it's not a best case scenario that these individuals are finding themselves in. The second piece is, you know, you look at our public transit system. You can't do drugs on our public transit system. We can't tolerate people smoking crack in a crack pipe on the 505 streetcar. And it happens every day. So that there needs to be the enforcement of the rules and the laws that are already on the books, whether that's in our parks or on our transit system or in our community centers. Those are not places for open air drug use. And as a city, we have to wrap our arms around this issue and just say, you know, it's gone too far. Enough is enough on this. We need to make all of these public facilities safe for everybody. And it's not safe for a young family or a senior or, frankly, any other transit customer to be sitting on the back of the 505 streetcar while someone's lighting up a crack pipe. That's just not something I can tolerate as mayor. So those are some of the things that we have to deal with in the immediate moments. But I'm also not prepared to wait for these additional consultations and reviews on laws that have been discussed for years, laws that we know need to be updated with respect to mandatory treatment. The time for action is now. I'm going to be a mayor who pushes for that.
Okay. Perfect timing. We're out of time. Brad Bradford, thanks so much.
Thanks, Libby. We'll talk to you again soon.
Yep. Bye-bye. Okay, that is all the time we have for today. Follow us on Instagram, follow us on YouTube. I'll be back here tomorrow, and we'll talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.